everyone. This is the Stark Truth on Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Robert Stark. My guest today is William Van Nostrand. So your website is ridingthetiger.org.
That's correct.
And the basis of that is the work of Evola. So you can talk about how that kind of inspired your website and the ideas you talk about.
Right. Well, we definitely take our inspiration from Evola, but we also, basically any traditionalist author, we kind of try to tie in just about any of the authors from his kind of school of thought would be Fritjof Schoen or René Guénon, or even other authors who we kind of see as reflecting similar ideas, but not necessarily traditionalists like Oswald Spengler, even Jim DiStabico and such from earlier on. Basically, the reason we started the website, or the reason we choose Evola as a, or at least the Ryan the Tiger name, and we kind of use him a lot, is, I mean, if you look around in political discourse today in the mainstream, you've got your Republicans, you've got your Democrats, you have certain ideas which are, you can discuss, you have certain ideas which are kind of taboo now, let's say, regarding feminism or whatever, or certain, like, let's say, national socialism, fascism, whatever, those are all taboo. But then you have other ideas which are just taken for granted, and you just, we don't even discuss them. We don't even really, there's no discourse. For example, we're just brought up, raised to believe that democracy or feminism or certain things to a certain point are good, and there's no real examination of that. It's just we assume that progressives kind of, that we're emerging from darkness, from the dark age of religion and backwardness, and we're now moving to a more scientific age, an age of rationalism. I suppose maybe it's all tied to the Enlightenment, but there is no one really outside of Evola and these traditionalists who's saying, well, wait a minute, not everything about the modern world is good. Not all, why are we for democracy? Why are we for these things? And I think it's important to have that voice.
And can you go into some more details? I mean, you are saying that Evola was a traditionalist. What was his take on traditionalism specifically? I know he's somewhat controversial because he did support Mussolini.
Well, his support for Mussolini was qualified. For example, to let him speak for himself here, I think he said something along the lines of his views are basically the views of any well-adjusted person prior to the French Revolution. So if there was any coincidences with the fascist movement or the National Socialist, it was basically that he thought that there was some hope maybe in the energy or the vigor or the idea of a new man and such that came out of that, that could be guided into a way that would kind of turn it into a traditionalist movement. They weren't traditionalist movements, but he saw there was some hope in, on some level for them. But he basically said, and I think it was an article in one of those fascist newspapers, saying that we're fascist to the extent that we agree with their tenets and anti-fascist to the extent that we don't. So he was very consistent in his own views, which weren't necessarily always the views of the regime. He didn't apologize for them either, and he didn't apologize after the war. He basically maintained the same views before, throughout his life. And when he changed, it wasn't because of... any changes, rather, weren't due to political pressures or the political climate of the time.
And there's a, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about traditionalism. To you, what does traditionalism mean? Does it mean a lot of people think it just means that going back in time? But I think the core part of it is rejecting a lot of these new ideas. And that, and the other misconception is that conservatives are traditionalist.
Absolutely, yes. Those definitely are two misconceptions. Well, also there's the idea that perhaps that they're either religious fundamentalists, just run-of-the-mill monarchists, and both of those aren't true either. As far as conservatives go, conservatives are as far from a traditionalist view as most liberals are. Both of them are both come out of... if you really look at the political discourse, conservatives are just as willing to praise a lot of these progressive ideas. They just praise progressive ideas from a slightly from, let's say, a couple of generations ago rather than the ones that are out right now.
Yeah, like the they'll say they support the earlier feminists, but not the newer feminist.
Exactly, exactly. I suppose you could say that the liberals are kind of they're pushing ahead with more and more subversive ideas, while conservatives kind of are content to keep it as it is. But as it is, it's still a problem. They're both neither one is really addressing the roots of the. Of why we have problems. And both sides, I believe, agree that there are problems with the way the world is right now. Absolutely. But in the side of liberals, I'd say they're just misguided. Well, on the side of conservatives, I'd say they're content with the way it is, but they don't want to see any change either way. They'll defend, for example, they'll be opposed to certain ideas today, but if 20 or 30 years down the line, all the legislation the liberals are pushing for goes through, the conservatives will defend that as if it's conservatism. And they've been doing that for the last 100, 200 years.
And the other thing about conservatives is that the sort of basis for modern conservatives is mass consumerism and sort of this hyper-capitalism, which is not at all traditionalist either.
I think that started with the shift from, I suppose, landed aristocracy and the like to basically moneyed capitalists, industrialists being the real sources of power, when basically having the most money and such, rather than having a title or being some kind of noble, became the most important thing in society, because who controlled the media, who was able to, you know, push things. So conservatism today is much more about protecting, for example, businesses, corporations, etc. And that's not really what the quote unquote the far right or the traditionalists are for at all, of course. And the liberals, of course, address the same problem. They say the same thing. They always accuse them. They level conservatives of being always friends to big business, or say they kind of tie anyone on the right, which they would consider lump anyone there, which would be traditionalists too. They'd lump them in there. And saying that they're basically for the same thing, or trying to portray them as just a more extreme version of conservative, which, as we said before, is just not true at all.
So I'm looking at this article. It's about, is Southern agrarianism America's final hope? About Southern agrarianism, how would you describe Southern agrarianism?
Well, basically what we're trying to get to there is, just what we were just talking about before, the difference between landed kind of value of land or value of capital. And the ideal for a traditionalist is always more of a rural society, more of a, as opposed to like urban, the city life and the banks and the factories and such. And it doesn't necessarily mean like a large landowner or anything like that, but we're just saying something more along the lines of more loosely united, like the townships, independent townships, small farms, communities that are kind of more self-sufficient, the way things used to be. In that sense, we are looking back, but we think it's not something that it's necessarily something backwards. Or just because it's something that you don't see in discourse doesn't make it backwards. Society today is very much relying on factory farming and such like that, and this kind of once again disconnects people from the actual process. It disconnects them. It basically makes them, they see food in their plate, but they don't know where it came from. They have no ability to really, they have no understanding of it beyond that they buy it and they eat it. There's no connection to the organic process of it.
About the Southern agrarianism, it's all sort of, a lot of it's about sort of localism and decentralization, but that gets back to the sort of about liberals and conservatives. Conservatives, their focus is mainly that government, people, they just talk about people becoming self-sufficient from like government programs, like cutting back welfare. But I think the key of this is about this agrarian issue is becoming self-sufficient from big corporations. And you mentioned things like factory farming. Yes. Some of these Southern agrarian ideas are Southern agrarian philosophers. I know one of them is Wendell Berry.
Well, yeah, the thing with conservatives is that they pay lip service to these ideas. They pay lip service to the whole notion of, independence from big government. But basically their main focus, once again, is they're still for centralization to a certain extent. They still they might not be as much for like government social programs the way the left is, or like the American left is, but they still certainly have, you know, it's just they want to put money into different programs that are still part of the federal government. And of course, their idea of decentralization, or their idea of loosening the restrictions, is loosening restrictions on big corporations to pretty much do what they want. To put it in simple terms.
So, are there similarities with I know the British sort of distributist movement, which has a lot of its origins in, it's sort of a Catholic movement, among a traditional Catholic movement, came about in response to the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Distributism is definitely an idea that influences that, or guild socialism. Many of those ideas where it's more about like a small community kind of cooperating and basically try as self-sufficient as you can. For granted, no community's ever going to be self-sufficient entirely, but it's just a much healthier, much more normal way to live. And it was a way that our grandparents lived. It's a way, there are, of course, people still live like that now. There are, of course, communities that are like that now. But, you know, it was much more common in the past. It was a much more healthy, normal way to live than living in cut off in urban environments, especially in the big cities in America and Europe.
You wrote this article called In Defense of Chivalry. And I'm a little bit – so you're saying that you're – are you defending chivalry today? Because a lot of people will say that – the men's rights activists will say that chivalry is obsolete today because of feminism.
Well, I kind of find that there's a problem to – especially this is a problem with some of the movements on the right. Maybe be they men's rights or certain things. For example, a lot of like the white nationalist movements use this too, where they say, well, what about like if we need like a white civil rights or something? And I think those movements, the problem with those is that they come from this whole same idea that a lot of the like feminists and those movements come from, which is very which is victim politics. And while I mean I understand where they're coming from and they might have some point on some level, I don't think we should be even we should completely ignore victim politics. I think that's not the way to go with anything. I think in the past, you look at any great society, any great civilization, they didn't focus on how badly they were oppressed. There was no monuments in Rome to their worst losses or anything of that sort. They carried on and they built on to their successes and their victories. And it should be the same thing here. It should be the same thing in the West now as it was until. So maybe the last century, when suddenly becoming a victim was, it's almost seen as a virtue. You become a victim in some way or another. You can say, well, I've suffered this much, so I deserve this much. And I think definitely, of course, chivalry's the ideal. It's the ideal even before Christianity, before Christendom, even though that's, I suppose, where most people think of it, like the errant knight and such. And it's universal in a way. I mean, you see it in the East, you see it in the West, you see it in virtually any society.
There's the issue of, you talk about these different activists, white activists and men's activists, who you think they play the victim game. But the thing about chivalry is that it becomes, chivalry, if it's going to be practiced, doesn't it have to be something that's earned?
Well, it certainly does. I believe, for example, I always say that when it comes to this, the knight errant who dedicated himself and he defended the honor of a fair maiden or something in the past to the princess or someone who was a maiden. They didn't go out defending the bar wench or anything like that back then, and they shouldn't be doing that now.
So you're not advocating sort of unconditional chivalry?
Oh, no, I don't think anyone ever did. I think that... they, like I said, they didn't advocate that back in the day either. These things were, everyone in their proper place. If someone is, someone's a decent person, someone has virtue. If it's a woman with virtue, you have to be willing to stand up for her if she's your people. But if she's like I said, if she's some wench or something, that's entirely different. Then why should you defend her? And unfortunately, quite a few of the women in modern society, perhaps because of feminism, because of the social climate, are not decent women. And that's to say, men are in the same boat. Men are kind of being raised to kind of just be you know, on Jersey Shore and all that junk, so they kind of, they're the same way. They don't really deserve much respect either.
One of the criticisms that the men's activists have is that you have these self-proclaimed conservative feminists, and that they kind of want it. They kind of want it both ways. They sort of want the benefits of feminism, but they want men to sort of be chivalrous.
Oh, absolutely. You definitely see that. From holding a door or anything like that, to the whole idea of, for example, like hitting a woman, you can't, if you hit a woman, it's considered, you know, how dare you? Even if it's a slap, you can't hit a woman. But at the same time, you can hit a man, a woman can even hit a man, and it's not a big deal. And, I mean, it's, once again, it's common sense. Of course, a man, generally speaking, is going to be stronger than a woman. So, in that sense, they're still kind of implying that women are the weaker sex. It is definitely, like you said, it's definitely they want all the privileges and none of the responsibility. And this goes with the workplace, too, where you need to have quotas on how many women you hire, anything like that. I suppose affirmative action for women, you'd call it.
So your next article is the two types of anti-modernism. And you reference this libertarian blog. Brendan O'Neill's a libertarian activist, and the context originally of this article is about the pro-Tibet campaign and about the Dalai Lama. And you're not opposed to the pro-Tibet campaign, but you're just sort of pointing out the hypocrisy of you point out the sort of the hypocrisy of the Dalai Lama in Tibet as actually a theocracy. And it's sort of become trendy for a lot of these people on the left to support Tibet.
Oh, to be sure, yeah. Like I was saying, I think I said this earlier, is that right now, like liberals still keep these pet causes, which like they see certain aspects of the modern world, certain little things that they find wrong, and they attach themselves to these causes, these ugly symptoms of the modern world, but they ignore root causes or completely don't understand how supporting, like having the platform they do, basically implies that they're supporting this and a bunch of other far worse effects of modernism, of liberalism, of progressivism. They prefer to focus on trivial, you know, frivolous issues or issues that don't concern them or really don't connect to our society at all. For example, what's going on in Tibet. I think Tibet, yeah, sure. I mean, I, you know, the Free Tibet movement basically was honest because let's face it, in the 50s, Tibet was a theocracy. That was it. It was the Dalai Lama basically ruled it as a, you know, pretty much essentially the equivalent of an absolute monarch, which would fly in the face of most of the, you know, most of the ideology that liberals hold, most of the things that liberals hold dear. And the Dalai Lama's made statements since that time that completely fly in the face of most of the things that liberals hold dear. So why do they continue to support? Do they really believe that a free Tibet or Tibet under the Dalai Lama is going to be somehow some kind of liberal kind of progressive state? Or do they, I mean, Dalai Lama certainly doesn't give any indication that it will. So it kind of just shows how this one issue, I mean, there's plenty more like it where they attach themselves to a cause without really thinking about it, I guess.
Is Brendan O'Neill, is he trying to claim that liberals hate modernity?
Well, they hate, like I said, they hate certain aspects of it. They certainly hate certain things about it. Like, they might lament certain little things here and there. For example, with environmentalism, they might say that, oh, we're ruining our environment, but they don't realize that they don't, you know, they don't put two and two together because it was liberal ideas. It was the whole idea, the whole progressive idea, which, you know, led to drive in industrialization, which led to drive in a lot of those movements like the clearing of the forest and such. It was the conservatives and it was the the traditionalists, I would say, who were opposed to all of that, who were kind of, you know, on the other side of that, saying that we're lamenting the loss of forest, lamenting the loss of like traditional landscape in Europe, anywhere in the world, and saying, well, what are we doing? The progressives, the liberals, were always saying that they're stuck in the past and that we need to move forward and such. And, well, nowadays it's the exact opposite. And actually, that's another example, but it's the same thing. It's the exact opposite with a lot of liberals attaching themselves to environmentalism. without realizing that, once again, it's their own ideas that got them there.
So you're pointing out Western liberals are, they're totally kind of content with these aspects of consumerism, their MacBooks and buying coffee from Starbucks and supporting unrestricted immigration. So obviously they're not, with the ecological issue, it's more of a kind of a trendy thing, but you don't think they're that serious about it.
No. I mean, they might on the bottom, like on the bottom levels, like the grassroots level, might be serious about it, but I certainly don't think on the top they really are.
Yeah, like those people who, I mean, like the people who chain themselves to the redwoods, like the hardcore environmental activists, those people are definitely serious about it, but your average upper-class liberal, sort of, it's more kind of a trendy thing. They don't take it that seriously.
Oh, yeah, it's to pay lip service to something more than anything. I mean, once again, really, most of them don't really care for any change at all, and especially if it's going to hurt them in their purses.
It's the same kind of with the diversity stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's more just sort of a trendy thing, but they don't choose to partake in diversity in their personal lives.
Not in my backyard. That's what they say.
So you were saying that the conservatives were the ones that sort of took on these free market ideas, and that's how the ideas of conservatives terminology changed around. And then you go on to talk about how the neoconservative strain of thought, its origins are from the Frankfurt School and the Trotskyites.
Yes. Well, Irving Kristol, the Jewish Trotskyist, until maybe the mid-70s, founded neoconservatism, and quite a few other major figures in neoconservatism are ex-Trotskyists, and basically just replaced the Marxist part of their kind of world ideology or international ideology and made it into something else. But it's really the same thing. It still benefits the same people. It's not real conservatism. The fact that these people even can be considered conservative shows how conservatism has changed. You look at how basically a conservative from the 60s, like someone basically the ideas of Pat Buchanan or even Sam Francis, would be now completely considered on the fringe or really a pariah, which would, you know, in the 60s, these guys were probably moderates compared to quite a few of the people around at the time. Yeah, it just shows the shift in the thinking of conservatives just in that small time span.
Yeah, like Glenn, good example of that is Glenn Beck putting on that rally to claim the mantle of Martin Luther King.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Oh, and more recently, I think he, speaking of Glenn Beck, he actually put out some article, I think, condemning the Golden Dawn Party and war and threatening that it's spreading to the United States and such. And, I mean, someone from the right, that should be ridiculous because most of the ideas that the Golden Dawn stands for are basically ideas that he supposedly should be standing for as someone on the right. I mean,
and he doesn't just criticize them. He basically says they're full-blown Nazis.
Yes. And says that this is they're a big threat and that maybe they can't be in the United States and just a whole bunch of things. But it's, once again, it's ridiculous. It's it shows where we are and why, you know, it shows why conservatism is kind of an ideology that's it's loaded to lose from the start, because immediately they portray themselves as clinging to things, and progressives can always paint them as being kind of stuck in a certain mindset and needing to move forward. And their own track record shows that that's pretty much true. They basically cling to an idea, and once it's pushed enough, they will back down. You look at any of the issues, any of the social issues today, conservatives would have all been against them, yet now you see them, like you said, like praising Martin Luther King and such. They've just changed their tune with the time because they realize that that's how they get votes, that's how they're going to get the funding. They don't really hold these ideas in any, you know, these ideas aren't very close to their heart. They just say what needs to be said in order to appeal to that part of the population, that part of the electorate.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if conservatives 30 years from now support gay marriage.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, to be sure. And even just now, what did Romney? It was a perfect example. I believe he said something to the effect that he would not put any new abortion legislation out, even though a few months ago he was saying something of the opposite when he was trying to court the more conservative members of the Republican Party. But we knew nothing was going to change there. I mean, Bush did the same thing. Everyone was saying, I remember when Bush was running, I believe on the second term, that if Bush won the election, he had the House, he had the Senate, and he was going to push through all this crazy, you know, conservative legislation, and it didn't happen. I mean, he certainly took care of his friends in Israel. He certainly took care of them. And, of course, his friends in big business. But I didn't see any legislation like that. I think we're in the same place we were culturally or socially as we were today, as we were in the Clinton era. I mean, we're certainly worse off. But
that's the thing with the religious right. I mean, they have some clout on a state, on the state level. Like in some southern states, they're able to put in legislation. But they're really just sort of the useful idiots for the Republican Party. And you pointed out the two big interests that sort of dictate the policies in the conservative movement are the Israel lobby and the big corporate interest.
Well, definitely. And a lot of that also is thanks to the evangelical Christian Zionists, who definitely are, I mean, the Jews themselves, obviously, the actual, like the Jewish lobby, the Zionist lobby, the AIPAC and such, they have, you know, they wield a huge influence, but they wouldn't be able to wield that influence if it wasn't for the fact that there was on top of the media and such like that. But it's also, like I said, the evangelical Christians who are enthusiastically supporting them on some crazy tenet about the fact that if we defend Israel or they build, I think, what is it, they build a temple that, what is it, the third or the fourth temple now of Solomon in Jerusalem, that they're going to, it's going to start the rapture or something of that, to that nature. And that's plain old crazy. I mean, that's the fact that people like that, we talk about Iran, we talk about a state like some Muslim states who, you know, push for religious law. I mean, they're not pushing for things like that at all. Or they don't, you know, anyone who firmly holds those beliefs, I mean, that's, to me, that sounds crazy. That sounds like a much more unstable or unbalanced way to run a society than anything coming out of the Islamic world. Except maybe, like, of course, for maybe, like, the most fundamental, like, Wahhabi sects.
And the other thing you talk about in this article is you get into these people in Europe, like Geert Wilders and the English Defense League. So you don't really view them. They're not nationalists, but they view Muslims as a threat to sort of a liberal values.
Oh, absolutely. Their discourse has nothing to do with traditional Europe.
Yeah, because about Geert Wilders, he says his main line is that Muslim immigrants are a threat. Basically, he says Muslim immigrants, they're anti-Semitic, they're anti-gay, and anti-feminist.
He talks about them being against our European values, quote unquote. But our European values, according to him, are post Enlightenment, completely liberal values, which traditional Europe did not hold. Our traditional Europe had far more in common with the Muslim world, like today, than it did with anything coming out of like modern Europe right now. I mean, modern Europe, in a lot of ways, the social mores over there are disgraceful. Not that the United States is much better. But the fact is, these people are supporting basically liberal states. They're supporting liberal, in some cases, like in France, Republican states, and not supporting any kind of traditional European order. Which, granted, if they were to say something of the nature, well, we want to keep Europe's character, you know, let's say fundamentally like France's character French, or the Netherlands, you know, Dutch, that would be one thing. But they're basically targeting Muslims specifically, rather than targeting the whole the issue of immigration. For example, basically, if the same people came over to Europe, instead of being Muslims, were, I don't know, atheists or, you know, out-and-out communists or something, they would have, according to the ideology that I gather for, that I understand from Wilders or any of them, would be that they would welcome with open arms, as long as they're, quote, able to assimilate. But the whole notion of assimilating kind of makes the European identity kind of a shallow, transient thing, just based on conforming to a certain set of ideas.
And I mean, and some of those, a lot of those types like Wilders, they seem to be tolerant of non-European immigration as long as it's not Muslim.
Exactly. Look at, what's her, I think, I'm not sure now.
Mercy Ali, yeah.
Yes, yes.
They love her. They love her because she's anti-Muslim, but she came out and said that the Vlaams Belang Party and the Flemish Nationalist Party should be outlawed for racism. But they love her. They think she's great just because she's against Islam.
Yeah, they can also, anytime anyone accuses them of being racist, they can tote her out there and say, well, look, we've got her in the party now, so it's maybe it's even an issue of tokenism on their part. But absolutely, they definitely, they don't truly support traditional Europe, so I don't see a single reason to support them. As far as I'm concerned, they're far worse, because at least one of the few good things about Islam in Europe is that they do tend to present a different worldview. They do tend to give Europeans an example of something. I know, of course, there's plenty of problems associated with it, but certainly their social values, their family values and such should not be considered something to be condemned. You know, the fact that they have social roles and all that. And, of course, their views on, let's say, homosexuality, on abortion, tend to be far more conservative. A real conservative, a real nationalist would see the common ground and not be attacking them on it.
Well, you have this article is about an alliance between Muslims and the European far right in Europe. You didn't write that article. It is by a Muslim in France.
Yes. That's just a translation of the article someone wrote for us there. No, definitely. It was encouraging to see it coming from a Muslim, because it, to me, seems obvious. To a lot of people, a lot of traditionalists, should be obvious that Muslims or anyone who is still has religious values would be a natural ally. And instead, we're opposing them, particularly because they do. For example, all these cartoon controversies and everything. And I've said this many times. We should be the same way about Christianity in Europe as the Muslims are about defending their own faith. I mean, the fact that you can make, for example, like that His Christ artwork, or the Virgin Mary made out of dung, and this is openly displayed, and this isn't a problem, and then no one really is going to protest it, and not to the extent no one is up in arms about it the way the Muslims are about the image of Muhammad. And we should, instead of seeing that as, oh, look how stupid they are, and this and that, usually that's the discourse, so look how crazy they are. Well, we should be saying, to an extent, sure, I mean, yeah, there's definitely some excess there. But on the other hand, well, we should be the same way about Christianity. We should be the same way about our own views, about our own faith, but we're not. Unfortunately, we don't have any faith anymore in just about anything in Europe and the United States. We kind of just see it as maybe a cultural marker in most, but you never see people defending Christianity the way Muslims, even Muslims who aren't as deeply religious, will defend their faith more than Christians will. And this isn't a bad thing. This is a good thing. And we shouldn't complain about we shouldn't use this as an example of them being problematic. We should use this as an example to follow, to an extent.
So if you think the criticism of Muslims should be mainly focused on just purely the issue of Europeans being displaced?
Definitely. I think that's an issue of just immigration in general. I think it doesn't matter where you're from. If we had, for example, let's say in Ireland, they had, I think, over 500,000 people from Eastern Europe, and these people are European. But the fact is, Ireland, or like the Republic of Ireland, only has, I think, 3.5 million people. If your country is only this, only has that many people to begin with, and you have this large group of people coming in, you can always take in small groups, and yeah, they can assimilate into a country. But when you have a group like that, it's simply impossible. They're not going to assimilate. You're going to displace the population. It doesn't matter whether they're industrious or hardworking, or they're accused of being lazy, or prone to criminality.
And the thing is, you're talking about some of these politicians in Europe. I mean, Geert Wilders has a lot of flaws, but at least, I mean, he has a lot of flaws, and the EDL, they have a lot of flaws, but at least they're for immigration restriction to a degree. I mean, these neocons in America who are bashing Islam, they have no problem with a mass immigration at all.
Well, yeah, in America, they come from two different sides. Like, the liberals, of course, come from the whole knee-jerk emotional, why not? We were all immigrants and such. Well, the conservatives come from more of a business standpoint point of view. Well, it's cheaper to hire immigrants. It keeps costs down. It keeps these people aren't in unions. These people they can hire for nothing. And it's not, once again, the problem with the EDL or any of these movements when they talk about immigration is they tend to target the immigrants and blame the immigrants when the problem isn't the immigrants. I mean, basically the problem is the way the government's set up and the way the business practices are set up. I don't blame, for example, if some Mexican crosses the border because he wants to get a job and wants to provide for his family. how can anyone blame someone for that? Or in Europe especially, you have someone living in, let's say, I don't know, Somalia, and they know they can come to Europe, they can go to Sweden, they can go to any country, and they're going to get plenty of benefits, and they're going to be set up, whether they work or not. I mean, can you blame someone for jumping at the opportunity? I certainly would if I was in Somalia, if I was in any country and with either war-torn or with serious problems, the way quite a few countries in either Africa or the Middle East or such have. So the problem isn't necessarily immigrants, and but most of the like the EDL and such will try to blame it on the immigrants and try to make it sound like they even when they do approach the issue or they do address certain issues, which, like I said, like mass immigration and displacement, when they do address the issue, they address it from the wrong standpoint, which is once again that these immigrants are attacking our Muslims are attacking our liberal European values. The EDL also has, I believe, is really pro-Zionist, and that's another sign that your organization isn't really, I would say, isn't really serious about defending Europe, is that they tend to be very pro-Zionist. And same with Wilders, I believe. I think he was even in Israel recently. The same with Glenn Beck. Well, same with most of the American conservatives, for that matter. They're all very pro-Israel, and it's not consistent, because the fact that Israel was there creates a lot more problems, creates most of the, for example, now there's a lot more Iraqis in Europe, and now there's going to be a lot more Syrians in Europe and a lot more Libyans in Europe now than there would have been had we not gotten involved in these conflicts.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's happening in with the Golden Dawn. The irony is the neocons, like, well, Glenn Beck's bashing the Golden Dawn because there was one controversy that a Golden Dawn member beat up an Iraqi immigrant. And, I mean, it's not really the fault of the Iraqi immigrants because their country's destroyed, but who destroyed their country?
Exactly. And it's just they don't see cause and effect. It's the same thing with the liberals. It's the same sickness that all these people, like, I suppose, even in mainstream discourse and political discourse have. Example of that recently with the ambassador being killed over there. Well, we went over there and we, you know, under a ridiculous pretext of defending civilians, we bombed civilians and we essentially let loose, you know, of course, they were all probably armed and supported by us. Of course, that'll come out maybe in a couple of years. They never bring this out right away. But how much, let's say, the CIA or had to do with this so-called Libyan revolution. But they dragged Gaddafi to the streets. They killed members of his family. They killed him. Thousands of people were no doubt killed in this. And then they're completely shocked when something happens to their ambassador over there. And to me, I mean, how did you expect nothing to happen? You expect that people were going to be all, you know, everything was going to be kumbaya as soon as you killed off Gaddafi. Well, it's not. It's going to be far worse now over there. All they see is they don't see past yesterday. All they see is how could these people do this? How could someone, you know, go in there and kill the ambassador? Well, they don't see, well, wait a minute, but didn't we install these people? Isn't this a government that we just finished basically installing?
So did you write about Occupy Wall Street?
Yes, there's, I think, two articles. I wrote one and Ray Wilson wrote one more recently.
So what you were kind of saying about it is that Wall Street is economically, it's a kind of a it is a, what is a parasite and how it's kind of destroyed middle America. But the thing is, these people in middle America, they just sort of see all these, like, they see the protesters as a bunch of kind of just crazy leftists. And that's kind of your criticism of that.
Well, that's one of them, absolutely. On one level, yeah, on the surface of it, these protesters do their own movement a disservice because, well, number one, they are misguided. They don't really have – their solutions are all over the place. There's no unity of thought, and maybe they always saw that as an advantage during the protest, but it really wasn't because they have no unity of purpose. There's some who are saying we're focusing on one issue. Some who are focusing on another, and none of them are really giving a coherent message out there. Then there's the fact that most of the people are being hurt by this, like you said, the middle and lower classes, the workers and such. They see these people going out there, and they see this, you know, people covered in piercings, covered in tats and blue hair, and just looking like they're homeless. They're looking like they're just weirdos, and they don't identify with these people at all. They don't identify with, you know, people who look like they've probably never worked a real job a day in their lives. They don't identify with that, and they're not going to. They're instantly going to be turned off to whatever they're saying, no matter what it is. It doesn't matter if it's completely true. It doesn't matter if it rings true on every level. They're not going to want to pay attention. I know. I mean, I've heard it myself many times from people. They see these people, even if they're the ones suffering from what's going on, they still see these people, you know, they look at them derisively. Also, they tend to, once again, they prefer the Band-Aid solution, which is, once again, more federal funding, more more of a social welfare net, more democracy, more liberalism, rather than saying, well, wait a minute, maybe it's less of these things that we need, or maybe it's, I think, maybe Ron Paul is the only one saying anything different as far as any kind of significant political movements go, because I think he was, of course, criticizing Wall Street too, but from a different standpoint as the from most of the leftist protesters.
Well, neither of them, both views are simplistic. Not the problem with Wall Street, because one side defends Wall Street, or the libertarian types, they're against the bailouts, but they have no problem with big banks as long as they don't use government funds. All those arguments are flawed. That's kind of goes back to what we were talking about Southern agrarians and the distributist. Of sort of the economic decentralization, and I mean the other thing is, I mean, in the past, I mean, the people on the right, you had people like Ezra Pound. I mean, Ezra Pound was considered a right-wing extremist by some, but he was very much against usury. And now, if you say anything about bankers, you're a leftist.
That's right. That's right. They kind of tend to not realize the same with the environmentalism, as we said before, and other things. That if you attack businesses or you attack certain issues like that, you're instantly, you must be a leftist, you must be a communist. I've heard this myself many times. It's very frustrating when you talk to people. And if I suppose it's if you tell them you're not interested in voting or you don't like Romney, or they'll instantly say, well, you must be voting for Obama. Or if you don't like Obama, oh, you must be right wing this and that. People don't, they see these roles and they don't realize that there's solutions and there's ideas that are, you know, beyond that. You know, one can be on the right without being completely for the oppression of working class. One can be have certain leftist ideas without being, for example, socially liberal. For example, you look at a lot of the old Soviets; they tended to be pretty crude in their values. And you look at the old Soviet Union, even in the '60s, compared to the United States, it was far more conservative socially, probably, than the United States was at the same time.
Or even a lot of the leftists in Latin America are socially conservative.
Oh, yes. I mean, take, for example, Fidel Castro until maybe about 10, 15 years ago. There was a lot of legislation there against homosexuality, against, you know, it was considered a mental illness. And this is, of course, today, you know, a lot of the people on the left who support him, they don't realize that, well, yeah, this is, they didn't see any problem with that. They didn't see this as being contradictory to their views, their ideology. Or I'd say, for example, Chavez, I heard a couple of years ago, was doing something along the lines of pushing for legislation to support women who wanted to stay at home and raise their children. They'd get a government help to an extent. And this might be, yeah, this might be a leftist solution, which would be social welfare. But still, the idea, once again, is women, you know, raising the children at home. And the fact that a leftist would support that must fly in the face and sting the feminists quite a bit.
You wrote about cultural hygiene and cultural capitalism, the two articles. One is Cultural Capitalism is Yet Another Road to Decadence and Despair. And I think the focus is there's a lot of talk about cultural Marxism, but no one ever talks about cultural capitalism. So earlier we talked about the Marxist versus capitalist economy. You also really get into the cultural aspect of Marxism and capitalism. What is your definition of cultural Marxism?
Well, I think that a lot of times we hear about cultural Marxism, and it's kind of a misnomer because it's almost nowadays, I'd say it's almost cultural capitalism. Cultural Marxism, I'd say it comes from the Frankfurt School in the '60s, and it focuses more on the social issues than it does on the economic ones. Cultural Marxism is more of an idea based on like social identity politics, anything like that. And I'd say we see this more in Europe and the United States now than we ever did in the old Soviet Union, which tended to have strict legislation on most cultural things in a way that would seem very conservative. You look at their art, their socialist realist art. Well, one of the things that we used to tout at the time was that, oh, in America, you have the freedom to either musically and the freedom of expression artistically. So you can make any kind of art you want. You can make any kind of music you want. And you see this with a lot of modern art.
Cultural capitalism, that is, are you talking about cultural freedom, or you're talking more about the kind of mass consumerism?
A little bit of both, a little bit of both, because most people, even in the United States, don't really care much for, like, most of that modern art, you know, and they don't care for a lot of those aspects of what cultural, let's say, cultural Marxism, cultural capitalism entails, but they do consume the whole pop culture, most of the other junk, without really thinking about it. But this was our, at the time, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and until recently, was our claim to something we used to hold up. Instead of seeing this as kind of, this is something we allow here, they don't allow, we kind of see it as a great thing that we have all this, for example, like I said, modern art or, trashy music. While in the Soviet Union, most of that stuff was either banned or there was strict legislation about it. And while we can say now that, socialist realist art was lifeless or was, it was the same images over and over. Well, what, you can go to the MoMA and look at the MoMA and see what's there. Let me tell you, I'd prefer socialist realism to just about anything out of there. And a lot of the, not, I wouldn't say the traditionalists, but I know Francis Parker Yaki was one of the people who said this, and he was, of course, on the far right, that the Soviet Union, it was more promising to be supportive of the Soviet Union, or the Soviet Union was more promising in a lot of ways than the West, because the West, and I think Evelyn said something similar too, is that the West, or that cultural capitalists or anything like that, they tended to attack society or chip away at the roots of traditional society from the inside and on a spiritual level, while most of the Soviets did was this very obvious kind of overt, for example, suppression of Christianity, suppression of religion, suppression of,
Yeah, and even though the Soviets, they did suppress Christianity, if you look at the former communist countries in Eastern Europe, they're much more culturally and ethnically intact than Western Europe, which was under capitalism.
Oh, absolutely. And the danger, too, is that when it comes to the media, is that because we always talk about the free media here, no one here really, most of the people, I mean, of course, there's people like, there's people who do look beyond it, but most people kind of just assume that, yeah, the media is free, so the media can, say anything it wants. Well, people in the on the other side of the Iron Curtain always kind of knew that, when you look at old Pravda articles, you can tell what's propaganda. You can tell, and you're kind of trained, or almost you have to read between the lines. And I think people develop that skill in Eastern Europe, and they never developed that in the United States to the same extent. And in Europe, they never really developed that to the same extent. They just kind of, most people, I mean, there are people who will look beyond it, but most people are just kind of going to open the newspaper or turn on the TV and kind of accept what they see and not really think beyond it. They might not think, well, wait a minute, why is, such happening, Especially that, once again, the last little conflict in Libya and now what's going on in Syria are two prime examples of it, where we have articles running constantly, articles with unidentified sources or sources who don't want to be named, who are talking about ridiculous things about, like, for example, there was one where they said that Gaddafi was distributing Viagra to his soldiers so they could rape people. I mean, these are insane, ridiculous things. But we just keep pumping out these articles after articles, and eventually people are going to say, even people who are on the fence are going to say, man, maybe we should do something over there. While someone, let's say someone in on the other side of the Iron Curtain back in the day would have kind of been able to see, okay, well, this is probably nonsense.
So what specifically, give some examples of cultural hygiene. Do you support a censorship?
I'd say, I'd say to an extent, it just depends on who's doing it, because basically right now there is censorship to an extent. It's just not in the same overt manner. Right now we do have it, but it's in a different way. Who's going to carry a book? Who's going to carry your songs? Who's going to, carry your articles? It's very simple. All of the media moguls, well, they already have, they can pretty much push anything they want and decide not to push anything they don't want. So you will have songs. For example, you go to a bookstore and most of the time you're not going to find Evelyn. It's very difficult to find Spengler or quite a few of these books unless you go out of your way and look for them. And most people aren't going to do that. And as long as that's the case, well, and the same with the college curriculum. We're only talking about certain things. Most people aren't going to look beyond that. Most people aren't going to bother with that. So,
well, the thing about it, I'm personally pretty much opposed to censorship, and especially if it's done in a totalitarian manner. But the problem really is, I think it does tie in with the economic issue. is how the Hollywood, the media, and the corporations, they create this sort of this mass homogenization of culture. Now, I think the solution is maybe looking into things like breaking up media monopolies, but I'd rather see that happen than actually full-blown censorship.
Well, yes, yes. But that's what I'm saying, is that, see, in America, we don't have, in the United States, we don't have the censorship. Let's say, for example, we might have in Germany on certain things politically. But there is still, it's not positive censorship, but there is a negative censorship in the sense that you can simply not write about something. You can simply not have an article in the paper. You can simply not carry a certain book. And, I mean, yeah, the book is still freely available if you go out of your way and look for it, or that song, or whatever. But most people aren't going to go out of the way and look for it. It's basically, it's not censorship, but it's denying information to people in a different sort of way. I think if the government, it's never going to happen here. But the government should, in the ideal situation, yeah, break up the media, you know, the media monopolies, and pump support into, let's say, either both aspects of local culture and try to do its, you know, and support local culture rather than a lot of the pop culture today. I think Samuel Francis wrote something about that too a few years back, something along the lines of how pop culture is completely eroding the whole idea of, like, local, for example, any kind of folk music, any kind of bluegrass, anything like that. It's destroying regionalism in the country.
Well, Bill O'Reilly is obviously not a traditionalist, but he says he's a culture warrior and a traditionalist, and now there's this battle going on between the secular progressives and the culture warrior traditionalists. But I think instead of focusing on the sort of socially conservative versus socially liberal fight, and that goes to these different issues by gay marriage and abortion and all that, I think encouraging more local culture and regionalism, I think that's sort of the way to go rather than this cultural homogenization. Some areas, say San Francisco, can have a socially liberal culture. Well, places like in the South can have a more conservative culture, but I think that I would rather see encouraging regional cultures and letting local communities kind of set their own standards than playing this whole sort of liberal versus conservative culture war.
No, to be sure. I think that's kind of the whole – I think it's kind of what we got out of the whole Ron Paul campaign, is that you have – on top of libertarianism is the whole idea, well – Let each state decide on a local level what it wants to do with certain things. And I think that, personally, I think that's the healthiest way. I mean, in the United States, you're never going to have a traditional society in the traditional European sense, because the society was built on the whole, on revolutionary principles. So you're never going to have that. But you can have at least some kind of healthy society. That's, I'd say, the best ticket to it in the United States. I think that there has to be certain standards and guidelines, and there's certain things that shouldn't be at all in terms of, let's say, for example, pornography or certain obscenity, you know. But by and large, I think that simply, you know, suppressing it isn't going to just do enough. You have to also, it has to be more about taboos and social understanding. I think, for example, you played most of the music and most of the movies today for someone, let's say, 70, 80 years ago, they would have instantly been repelled. They would have known that this stuff is garbage in a way that people today don't know, because it's so common. They just shrug it off.
But government, since the thing about government censorship is that, you're right, change has to really come to the culture and the mindset of the people. In a sense, government, having a government censorship would, in a sense, make things more taboo. But in a sense, government censorship, in a way, is make things sometimes more desirable.
Yes, it's a double-edged sword too, because a government today that has the power to suppress certain things, tomorrow might be run by totally different people with the same ability to censor things, and they're going to censor something else. But and that's the one problem with that. But I think there definitely has to be at least some standards on what can and can't be said. I mean, this was even true in this country in the 50s and in the 60s. There's certain things now that would never have ever been, in the mainstream, in either discourse or otherwise, in music or in movies or anything, that would never have been there then, that are here now because of obscenity laws. And I don't see a problem with that. I think that that's perfectly healthy. But, I mean, granted, one thing, this can't be too overt. You can't be, doing it the way it was done in the Soviet Union, because that kind of did allow certain bad things to proliferate, like, you know, like rock music or any of that. And none of that stuff is ultimately good. All that stuff comes out of that hole. Once again, it's all pop culture. It's all drivel. I mean, there are always a few shining, you know, gems in every artistic or cultural movement. But by and large, it's most of it's drivel. And it's not good for the people here or the people in Europe or the people just about anywhere.
So before we kind of wrap it up, you touched on the environmental issue, and you, this article, Environmentalism and Conservationism, from about a year, this is about a year ago.
Yes.
Well, you say a green traditionalist perspective, things that they might include, and you list agrarianism, hierarchy and organic unit, rebuilding foundations of culture, and localism and regionalism, and these are things we've touched on, but you can sort of get into this.
Well, like I said earlier in the interview, is that, you know, in the 19th century, liberalism and progressivism were tied to industrialization and modernization, and how we're now in a new age of, you know, space and technology, science and technology, and, most of the social movements who've gained traction did so, you know, hand-in-hand with technological movements. That's more or less how slavery, for example, would be portrayed as an antiquated rural mode, and women's right to vote, birth control, and eugenics. All these ideas all cropped up at around the same time. And it was the conservatives who were opposing a lot of these trends, be they wrong or right, for example, with the issue of slavery and such. But they were tended to be the ones who were supporting conservation. I think another example of that would be, you know, granted it's a fantasy, would be like, I think J.R. Tolkien, he wrote Lord of the Rings. I think it's been interpreted quite a few times as a work against industrialization. And most of what he talks about it harks back to that whole hierarchical traditional society in a way. And you see that throughout. You see this a lot in, you know, America in the 19th century. For example, Thomas Cole, a lot of his paintings, especially I think The Course of Empire, I believe it's the second one, Arcadia, kind of portrays the ideal way that the country should go. And it's kind of a warning that once a country becomes too industrialized, too urbanized, it becomes decadent and it loses a lot of its character, all of its strengths. And if you look at history, this is kind of the case. I mean, you look at Rome. When Rome finally became this world city, the center started to collapse. It's when the society started to decline. While before this, when it was solidifying, when it was unifying, when it was organizing, when it still was relatively agrarian, this is where it built its strength. As far as environmentalism goes, like I said, extreme environmentalism isn't healthy either. We do need some, and I believe I said this in the article, we do need some sort of, you know, there has to be some industrialization. There has to be some sort of technological advancement, which unfortunately does mean the environment has to be changed to an extent. But this can be done in a way that doesn't require destroying everything. I think pollution, both pollution and extreme environmentalism, are symptoms of the same materialistic worldview. And that feminine kind of back-to-nature view on the other, they both would vanish in a properly oriented society. Traditional man sees skyscrapers and suburbs and does not see life. He sees the antisocial. He sees a dead environment. But at the same time, when he just sees a forest, he doesn't see a place fit for human life either. It has to be molded to some extent or another.
Well, I'd like to thank William Van Nostrand for being on.
It's been a pleasure.
And the website is ridingthetiger.org.
I'll be updating soon.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.